Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready!
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
1, 2, 3, 4!
Tame Impala, a band from all the way on the other side of the world in Perth, Australia, has conquered the U.S. I'm Greg Kot from the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. We've got Tame Impala live in the studio, and Greg and I review one of the most anticipated albums of 2013, the debut from Savages. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
That is Raining Blood from the Mighty Slayer, their 1986 masterpiece, Rain in Blood. One of the founding members of that Southern California metal band, Jeff Hanneman, died at the age of 49 of liver failure. As I said, a co-founder of this quartet, one of the most important metal bands ever, and really one of the best rock bands, period, no matter what genre, of the last 30 years. Guitarist and a key songwriter in the band. He wrote most of the music and contributed heavily to the lyrics on those key early albums, where they established that blueprint for that sound, that thrash metal sound, speed metal, if you will, based in the velocity and intensity of punk, but with those classic metal riffs at its core. And man, this guy brought the riffs. I mean, as a guitar player, he and Kerry King created this architecture of guitars on all of those classic Slayer tracks where the rhythm and lead parts were sort of blurring together. And then they would jump out of the maelstrom. One of the guys would take the lead, and then the other guy would take the lead. And it was like two race cars flying down this mountainside, you know, taking the curves at dizzying speeds. It was really amazing, not only to hear on record, but to watch these two guys go at it in concert was really just as great a concert experience as you could have if you were into the extreme side of metal. The subject matter of the songs, too, initially they got in a lot of trouble with the Parents Music Resource Center and all these censors who were saying, you know, they were exploiting the subject matter. They were in it for the cheap thrills and the shock value. But the subject matter, nuclear war, serial killers, psychopaths, the apocalypse, to me it was a type of protest music. I always heard it that way. Here's the way the world really is. Deal with it. Here's one of the classic tracks that Jeff Hanneman wrote the music for and also co-wrote the lyrics. It's War Ensemble from the 1990 album Seasons in the Abyss from Slayer on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
War Ensemble by Slayer on Sound Opinions in tribute to Jeff Hanneman, dead at 49. Greg, there's another great heavy band. It's Led Zeppelin with Your Time Is Gonna Come from their first album. But their time was not gonna come for a reunion at the concert to benefit the victims of Hurricane Sandy. I love this story. CBS News broke it. That event was put together by Hollywood bigwig Harvey Weinstein, and he really wanted a Led Zeppelin reunion to cap it off, help raise money for the victims of the hurricane. Zeppelin doesn't like coming back together. They've refused to do it, except for a handful of times, Live Aid back in the 80s, the concert for Ahmet Erdogan in 2007. Who are you going to get to put Led Zeppelin back together? Weinstein turns to President Bill Clinton. As president, he played a crucial role in the peace talks in Northern Ireland. Since then, he's gone to North Korea to free hostages. He's tried to put the Palestinians and the Israelis together in a room to come to an agreement. How hard could it be to get Led Zeppelin together? But they said no. Even though they were in the United States a couple of days before that Sandy benefit concert, they were honored in Washington at the Kennedy Center Honors. No way. Zeppelin wasn't going to do it. The concert had to settle for Paul McCartney playing with the surviving members of Nirvana. But that's only this is Sound Opinions, and you're listening to the song Music to Walk Home By from Tame Impala. It's the psych rock project led by singer Kevin Parker, who's got a reputation as an audio perfectionist, spending months and months on every detail of the band's recordings. And he's been this way since he began to make music at age 11. I think it's fair to say that the attention to detail has paid off on Lonerism, Greg, the band's 2012 record that wound up on both of our best of lists for that year.
The members of Tame Impala, Kevin, Dominic Simper, Jay Watson, Nick Albrook, and Julian Barbagello, joined us in the studio recently, and we began our conversation with Kevin's early bedroom recordings. And I started the conversation by asking Kevin about how he started down the road of bedroom recording at such a young age.
I guess it was just the obsession with hearing yourself played back to yourself, you know, like being able to just layer things on top of each other. I don't know, it just seemed like an amazing concept in a completely egotistical way, you know.
You had a tape recorder, you had, what, it was a 4-track, or what kind of gear did you have?
It was just a cassette. I just had found two cassette players in the house and recorded drums onto one of them and then played that back when I was, like, hitting a keyboard and then, like, recorded that into a new tape. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like it's like a really standard living room hi-fi tape recorder, and
that's
then got
really
that tape.
Primitive.
Oh yeah, super primitive. It sounded terrible.
How awesome! How old was this? What was the age?
11 or 12 or something. I don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the Tame Impala story really starts at 13. You're in Catholic high school, right, in Perth, Australia, and you meet Dominic Simper.
Yeah, that's when we started playing music together.
What did you see in each other that brought you guys together?
I instantly noticed that Dom was a better guitarist than me, and I was really jealous. And I was like, "No."
What were you guys listening to at 13?
I was just all things guitar and angsty, mm-hmm. And I just noticed Dom could shred insanely.
Okay.
All right, in fact, I think he was playing. I remember he was playing. Oh no, I heard some like Red Hot Chili Peppers playing in the room next to me because we had this like music class, and I thought it was someone who put on the CD, mm-hmm. And it was just Dom playing like Scar Tissue or whatever, uh-huh. And I was like, what?
Dom is here in complete silence, and he's running scales up and down the neck.
Yeah.
Right, so I think we got his number. We know. But you're not posing about it, Kevin. You're not saying, I was deconstructing Smile and trying to put it back together at age 13.
Oh, no, far from it.
13 years old, the two of you get together. You took it out of the bedroom, obviously. Did you get out and play some shows at that point?
No, not really. I mean, once a year, the school put on a fete, and all the bands could like play in the school hall while everyone else was like walking around eating fairy floss. And that was like the date that we looked forward to the most. We had like, you know, three people watching, but it was still the most amazing thing.
Is this an Australian thing, like Vegemite, fairy floss?
Oh, fairy floss.
Yeah. Oh. It's a new one on us, and we're curious.
Oh, cotton candy.
Cotton candy. All right, okay.
The band got going in 2010 with Interspeaker. That was the album that a lot of people took notice of here in the States. That was the first anybody had heard of you. So walk us through that transition from, you know, two guys making music in the hallway at school to making this incredibly elaborate debut album in 2010.
Well, they're always kind of separate, separate but sort of connected. There'd always be me in my bedroom making music, and then we'd play gigs. Sometimes not even the same song. Sometimes we play a completely different set list of any stuff I was recording. And some of the songs we played, I never recorded because they were just live songs, you know. I never really sort of thought that the live band and the recording project were... It had the same name, but that was about it. The name was the only thing that was really linked about it. Other than that, it was just like a completely different way of making music. And it's only really now, like the last couple of years, that there's a reason to tie the two together.
So really that first record was basically an extension of what you were doing when you were an 11, 12-year-old kid making those crude little recordings of yourself.
I still record more crudely than anyone I know. Like this recording session we're doing now is a lot more high fidelity than Lonerism was recorded. Hmm. I still record just as terribly as I always have.
What do you mean by that, though, exactly? I mean, people are saying, you get these beautiful sounds, and yet you're so deprecating about the
I don't know.
About the recording technology. What is crude about it? Is it just old stuff, or what it's, exactly are you using?
Well, it's just whatever I can get my hands on, really. I mean, the instruments I kind of take a lot of pride in, like the guitars and drums and stuff, but the microphones, like all the microphones I own just got given to me by our friend who has a studio because he felt sorry for me because I only had like one mic that I use on the drums. And sometimes I can't, if I'm in a spot where I got to record something and I don't have anything, then it's just going to be singing into the laptop mic, you know. In fact, I never did that on the album, but the lead guitar in Apocalypse Dreams is like the guitar just plugged with a lead and a headphone jack and like a jack plugged into the microphone input on my MacBook. And then just like screwed with it on Ableton. Like that's the sound. There's no pedals or anything. It's just, and that's pretty much as terrible as you get.
Well, Tame Impala is here in the studio with us on Sound Opinions. How about a song, Kevin?
This is Why Won't You Make Up Your Mind?
By Tame Impala. All right.
Why Won't You Make Up Your Mind by Tame Impala, live on Sound Opinions. Coming up after the break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, more music and discussion with Kevin Parker and the band. Then later in the show, Greg and I review the new album from the London-based post-punk quartet, Savages. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And our guests this week are the members of Tame Impala, the Australian band led by Kevin Parker, with a sound that's a mix of vintage Pink Floyd-era psychedelic and modern pop. Tame Impala's debut, Inner Speaker, received notice for this sound, and then they went on to enlist veteran record producer Dave Fridman for the follow-up, Lonerism. Fridman's credits include albums by The Flaming Lips, MGMT, and Mercury Rev. And we continued our conversation with Kevin, wondering why the band wanted to travel halfway across the world to upstate New York to work with the mysterious but congenial Mr. Fridman.
It was obvious, really, because we were all such massive fans of music that he's been involved with. It was just such a mystical thing, like the Dave Fridman sound and what he does. You know, it was like this. He was like a rock star to us.
And then you meet him, and he's like a high school basketball coach.
Yeah,
and you're like, you made that freaky music.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what it's like whenever you meet someone that makes like the most tripped out music you've ever heard. Is that they always just end up being a pretty chilled out normal guy.
Yeah,
it's just testament to how good he is. The distance that people travel to get there. I mean, like, New York State is, I think it's almost exactly the other side of the world for us. Like, if you draw
a line,
if you get a globe and drill a hole through uh-huh. Perth, you'll end up pretty close to New York City.
In upstate New York.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was surreal. I was jet lagged and I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about the album and I was going totally cuckoo.
Yeah. Well, we have heard you are an audio perfectionist, even sound checking for this session. What was it that Dave Fridman was able to do for you that you didn't think you could do yourself?
I don't know. It's hard to put a finger on, because if I knew what it was he was doing, then I'd be able to do it myself.
Then you could do it yourself.
It's because I don't know what it is. I listen back to his mixes, because I do like a rough mix before I give it to him. I'm just like, this is what I'm trying to do. He just has this way of giving it this extra layer of sonic, crispy goodness. I can't even... Yeah, it's because I can't even put into words or, know really what it is that makes it so appealing.
Okay.
Well, in some ways, I would imagine you're immersed in this recording for a year or more, and then it's just probably great to have another set of ears on it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've got the rest of the guys as well to, tell me what they hear. Because it's true, you totally lose perspective. Sometimes, listening back to it for the 50th time in a day, and you think it sounds like Basement Jacks or something. And your friends come in, they're like, dude, it sounds like psych rock.
So I would imagine Fridman, having talked to the man, it sounds like he could be a pretty good psychologist too. He'd be like a kind of guy that would be reassuring as opposed to oh, this is crap. We got to start all over
again.
Totally.
Yeah, he's the ultimate stabilizer. He's like, I'll be like, Dave, I'm freaking out. Like, you know, there's drums. I don't know if they're too loud or too quiet. He's just like, doesn't matter. No one's going to be thinking that, you know, because he's just like, the audience isn't going to know that there was another version of the drums where they were slightly quieter.
Uh-huh.
So he just, you know, but at the same time, he understands what it's like to get totally bugged out about making an album.
Of course. What record in particular of his that you heard led you to his place thinking, I'm on the right track here. This is a guy I want to work with. Was there any particular album or particular group song recording that he made that led you there?
Chronologically, Oracular Spectacular. We all just totally went nuts over that album.
And MGMT, right?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, like a few weeks later, we went to Japan and saw the Flaming Lips, and then became Flaming Lips slaves after that.
And it sounds like you've got certain qualities that you picked up from some of those recordings. I mean, I get the sense that you're not afraid of a little bit of distortion, sometimes a lot of distortion. There's beauty, but at the same time, there's also this love of this big, crunchy, noisy sound. And it seems like that's something that Fridman does well.
It's his bread and butter, mm-hmm. different types of distortion. But it's an art, because just distorting something doesn't necessarily make it sound good. Because there's that kind of distortion, that kind of crunchiness that has its own kind of emotion to it.
Mm-hmm.
But when something is like totally rumbling and like fuzzed out in a particular way, it makes you really fall in love with it.
30 years ago, they would have said it's a defective recording. You can't put that out.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
But you're okay with that. That's fine.
Oh, man, I wouldn't be able to live without it.
So Inner Speaker puts you on the map in a big way. The band is touring the world at that point, right?
Well, I mean, it was kind of just something that not thrust upon us, but it just became our lives, because we were signed to a record label and touring became a thing. And it was for us, it was this totally new thing. It's just a new experience of traveling all the time. Because up until then, we just played gigs in Perth, you know, every sort of few days. So yeah.
You were able to play that often, every few days, really?
Oh, you can play whenever you want in Perth. There's always places to play.
do people listen to you?
Yeah, sometimes. The audience doesn't even seem to be like a significant part of the thing. It's more just like inventing a band and then putting on a gig later that night. And if anyone's watching, then great. But if not, it doesn't matter.
How about another song, Kevin?
Yeah,
and tell us what you're going to play.
We're going to play Elephant. All right.
Thank you.
Tame Impala on Sound Opinions with Elephant. Killer tune. Thank you so much, guys.
No worries.
I'm glad you played that one because it's interesting. There's two songs on the last album, Lonerism, that Kevin, you wrote with Jay, who, as I said, has been part of the band, part of the crew since 2007. He's playing synthesizers at this session and eating an apple.
Is it bad if when you eat an apple, your gums hurt a lot?
Might be time for a visit to the dentist.
Yeah.
Do you have socialized medicine in Australia?
My mouth is really sore.
He was eating an apple for most of that song.
I'm glad you've got a mic, Jay, because I'm curious, how does Kevin write? How do these songs originate when he brings them to you guys and says, we're going to play them live? What kind of shape are they in, and what did you add to Elephant?
He just does them all himself and has like a 30-second demo of the chorus. Elephant, I'm not as proud of as Apocalypse. Apocalypse Dreams was my chords in the verse.
Yeah, Elephant. Great song.
Elephant, it turns out, my one contribution was accidentally ripping off Pink Floyd. So I'm not as entirely proud about that.
I got
Apocalypse Dreams, I am, you know, because I did more on that one.
So there are demos. There are roughed out ideas of what these songs are going to be when Kevin presents them.
Elephant is Kevin's song, and I just added a little bit in the middle. Mm-hmm.
Are you writing on acoustic guitar, Kevin, or are you constructing these songs in the studio with all these different sounds from the beginning?
Yeah, totally. It's just sort of building it from the ground up. It's just whatever instrument's lying around, it really dictates what the song gets played on. Yeah. In fact, we still don't know who wrote the chords for the solo, you know, like the instrumental break in Elephant. We still don't know who wrote the chords for that.
Hmm.
We have discussions about it.
Where did it come
from? Which sometimes turn to arguments.
It was definitely me, because Kevin never plays a minor and then does a major and then does a minor afterwards.
We also don't know who wrote the bass line of Apocalypse Dreams.
It's definitely
personally,
me.
I think it was me.
It's definitely me too, because I remember I remember when I played in the demo, I was like, doesn't this sound like Outkast, you know?
Oh, okay. Mm.
Yeah, I remember thinking that your chords sounded like the Jackson 5, so I purposely did a Jackson 5 bass line.
This is turning into like the Let It Be documentary where a band breaks up on film.
He's still eating some apple.
When I played it to him, I told him it sounded like Can You Feel It by the Jackson 5.
I'm glad Jay mentioned these words, Pink Floyd. Kevin, I this was my album of the year, Lonerism, last year.
Oh,
and I love this genre. I've spent a career writing about psychedelic rock.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you fall in love with so many of these sounds and this approach to music when, you know, for all intents and purposes, it was 40 years before you were born?
I don't know. Like, that's how we all kind of became friends. It was just love of crazy music. But, I mean, the Pink Floyd one's a weird one because I'm not even really a big Pink Floyd fan. In fact, I was the guy in the house that was always like, I didn't get Pink Floyd. Everyone was like a disciple, and I was like, I don't get it. I still don't listen. I don't listen to Pink Floyd. I can't even really listen to Syd Barrett Pink Floyd.
Mm. He used to do the most disparaging impressions of Syd Barrett. We're the ones
really?
That like Syd Barrett. He thinks he's hilarious.
I just don't get it. I mean, space rock. They started the space rock thing, but.
Right. But is it the whimsy that bothers you? You know, I've got a mouse, he hasn't got a house, I don't know why I call him Gerald.
It's whimsy.
It's just, a bit kind of
anti-whimsy.
Circus-y, I don't know.
Okay, all right.
Doop, 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 doop.
I can respect that 100%. As many people as I interviewed for my book, hundreds of musicians in this genre said, it was split right down the middle, said you have to take psychedelic drugs to be able to make this music, as said the other side, I've never taken drugs. The goal for me was all about creating a new world in that space between your headphones. Where do you stand on that issue?
I don't know. Like, we smoke weed sometimes. Some of the songs, I was stoned when I wrote them, and some of them I was completely sober. There doesn't really seem to be any correlation between whether you're high or not. It's kind of like if you can enjoy music sober and then you take drugs or do whatever and it's even better, then great. But if you need it, if you need the drugs to enjoy it, then it's kind of something wrong there, you know.
I remember realizing a lot of my naffest songs were the ones I wrote stoned because I thought they were really good and they probably weren't actually that good, you know.
Yeah.
I read somewhere once that Josh Homme or whatever from Queens of the Stone Age said he stopped smoking weed because he was driving home one day from the studio and it was a Britney Spears song. And it wasn't a good one either. It was like a newer one. And he thought it was like the best thing he'd ever heard or something. And then he realized, and then he was like, oh man, I got to stop smoking weed.
I was just going to say that the whole psychedelic music and crazy music things and drugs, they seem to like be a supplement for the other. For example, some of the people we know that are the most like out of it, you know, the biggest acid heads or whatever, they make the most simple, just cruisy music. And some of the most sober people we know make the most effed up music, you know. It's kind of like, if you're on drugs, you don't really need that kind of sonic explosion to satisfy.
So I want to throw out another band, and Jim mentioned Pink Floyd, Supertramp.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, they're, like, probably my biggest influence. And it blows me away how, like, people hear, the, like, the Syd Barrett, but they don't hear the Supertramp. Because all my melodies are kind of just that kind of, like... Especially the last album's got that kind of, like, blown out but still pop kind of thing.
So your lonerism is your answer to, what,
Breakfast in America? Yeah, totally.
Which is a great record, and I can see where you're coming from, because that guy in Breakfast in America is singing a lot of melancholy songs with these great, happy melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, you know, I want to get into the theme of lonerism itself. It obviously works as sort of a song cycle. Did you sort of approach it from the standpoint that I'm going to be writing a series of songs about this subject, or did it just sort of end up that way?
Yeah, I think it kind of just congealed slowly. I didn't really... No, I was writing songs that had this kind of theme going, if there is even a theme. I mean, you know, like, when I started to think about it as, like, an album, yeah, having, like, a thing, I found myself, like, just looking at the songs differently, looking at how that relates to, like, the whole lonerism thing, rather than, like, you know, starting out with this idea and writing 12 songs about that. It was kind of just, they all happened naturally.
Well, people extrapolate from that, you know, they think, okay, you know, guy who makes records by himself, you know, for years at a time, obsesses over these details, they're thinking you're writing about yourself. This is your life that you're pouring into these songs. How do you respond to that?
Well, I guess it is, at the end of the day. I pretend that it's not while I'm doing it so that I can kind of feel more confident about it, because I'm, you know, pretty self-conscious when it comes to writing lyrics, so I kind of just pretend that it's someone else, you know, and that kind of gets me to the other side.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. We are here in the studio with Tame Impala, and they're going to play another song. Kevin, tell us what it's going to be.
This is Feels Like We Only Go Backwards.
All right, let's do it.
All right, give us some tempo.
Yeah.
Feels like we only go backwards from Tame Impala on Sound Opinions. You are listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott with Jim DeRogatis. We're here in the studio with Tame Impala, Kevin Parker, Julian Barbagello, Nick Albrook, Dominic Simpa, Jay Watson. Thank you so much for coming in, guys.
No worries.
Thanks for having us.
You can hear all of Tame Impala's live tracks at soundcloud.com/soundopinions. While you're there, check out all of our archived episodes. And we want to hear from you. What's the next up-and-coming band you're listening to? Tell us at 888-859-1800. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, we review the new album from Savages, and it's my turn to drop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a track called Shut Up from Savages, a London quartet that has been a band for barely over a year. Got together in October 2011. Jenny Beth on lead vocals, Gemma Thompson on guitar, Aisha Hassan on bass, and Faye Milton on drums. They put out a single in the middle of last year that attracted a lot of notice in the UK press, a track called Husbands. Played their first U.S. gig at CMJ in the fall of 2012. Big reviews, big critical support. The next big thing from England, everybody was saying. Followed it up at South by Southwest Music Conference in March of this year. A lot of critics came away impressed. Jim and I both saw those gigs. We talked about it on this show. All leading up to the appearance of this debut album. Signed immediately after South by Southwest to Matador Records. Now it's finally here. Silence Yourself from Savages. Here's a track from it called She Will on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
Will by Savages from Silence Yourself on Sound Opinions. Greg, this is the sort of album that makes me happy to be a rock critic. Reminds me why I love this. I went out on a limb when we reviewed the band at South by Southwest and said I hadn't seen a front person this powerful since Kurt Cobain. What was I talking about? There's the charisma from Jenny Beth. That's one thing. Another thing is, remember when we first saw Nirvana? They arrived in the world fully formed. You know, this was a band with a complete vision and an idea and a sound, and boy, it didn't seem like they'd just come together. But more importantly, they were taking familiar ingredients and making them fresh. That is what any artist does. Everybody knows there's nothing new under the sun. Kurt was taking Black Flag, Black Sabbath, and Bubblegum. That was the recipe he gave us. He put it together for Nirvana. Savages are taking those post-punk sounds of Wire, stripped-down minimalism, and early Cure, Killing an Arab, kind of swirling guitar atmospherics, but also that angular punk propulsion of The Fall, let's say, or Gang of Four. We've heard these sounds before, but you listen to this band live and you feel like you have never heard music like this before. On the record, they let a record be what a record should be. It breathes. It has room to expand. There are washes of ambient guitar and all sorts of swirling atmospherics on about half the disc. I'm impressed by the band on album. I'm impressed by the band on stage, and I love its manifestos. It is telling the world all of this digital information is drowning you and keeping us from connecting with one another romantically, intellectually, civilly. They have this whole shut up, silence yourself manifesto. No cell phones at their shows or they're going to kick your butt. I love this band. I love everything about it. I love its ideas, its music, its live performance, and its album. Buy two copies of this and give it to somebody else you love because they need it too.
Well, they're a very serious band, and they're kind of scary. I mean, they attack you when they're up there on stage.
I love that.
And it's a great thing. You know, when you heard a track like Husbands for the first time, it's basically about, okay, silence yourself and confront the truth about your life. Suddenly you walk into your house and you don't recognize my house, my bed, my husband. All these things are new to me, and I don't know why I'm here.
Yeah.
That's basically what that song says, and it's really terrifying, you know, about your mundane existence. Do you really know the truth of it? And the ferocity of her vocals is really gripping. But I think the rest of the band, too, is hugely a big part of this.
Absolutely.
The guitarist Gemma Thompson, I think, is one of those post-punk guitar heroes in the mold of somebody like Gang of Four's Andy Gill or the Yeah Yeah Yeah's Nick Zinner, where they're kind of reinventing the instrument, using it to color and create all this atmosphere around the songs. I think she's just a genius on this record.
And that rhythm section.
Hassan on bass, it's a lead bass on most of the tracks. She's amazing. And Faye Milton on drums is a terrific drummer. It's a great little power trio behind Jenny Beth on vocals. This is a great debut album. It's going to be, you know, people are going to be hard-pressed to keep this out of their top 10 or top 5s by the end of the year. I think it's a buy-it album all the way.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Jim, as often as possible, we like to take a swim out to the desert island, plop down on the beach, pop a quarter in the desert island jukebox, and play a track we cannot live without. What are you going to play this week?
Well, Greg, I'd like to play more Savages, but we can't live by Savages alone. It was fascinating to me that during the Tame Impala interview, Kevin Parker mentioned Supertramp because, you know, he had the fearlessness to say, I'm going to say that this not hip at all band really influenced me because really all the hip rock critics would never say they love Supertramp. I don't care about such stuff. I love Supertramp. I really did. I'll never forget going to see the Breakfast in America tour at the Brendan Byrne Arena in New Jersey. Somebody had set me up on a blind date. And she was actually blind. It was a weird night. Anyway, Supertramp was a great band that was driven by your favorite instrument, keyboards. They were initially part of the progressive rock explosion, but I think that they were really more sort of an orchestral pop band, more than progressive rock. It was never about the virtuosity and the solos. It was about the songs. I'm going to play one of the songs I love. It's called Take the Long Way Home that underscores the best parts of the Supertramp legacy. It was a combination of two people driving the band, Richard Davies and Roger Hodgson. We had those high falsetto vocals. We had that wonderful keyboard melodic approach. We had a love of sort of threatening atmosphere. You know, this song, Take the Long Way Home, I don't even know what it's really about, because you don't with many progressive rock songs, but it creates a mood. It creates a mood of ominousness and of putting off the future, which isn't so promising. Don't feel that your life's become a catastrophe is one of the lines. Another Supertramp album was called Crisis. What Crisis? Memorable cover of a woman sitting in a lounge chair as if at the beach, but she was in the midst of a nuclear explosion. That's that band's aesthetic in a nutshell. Here's Take the Long Way Home by Supertramp on Sound Opinions. Supertramp with Take the Long Way Home from 1979, my Desert Island Jukebox pick this week. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to talk about the legacy and music of Joy Division with one of the founding members of that band, Peter Hook.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Tame Impala was recorded by Mary Gaffney and Adam Yaffe. Sound Opinions is produced by Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, and Annie Minoff. And our fearless leader, our executive producer, Tori Southside Malatia. We should try to get him to put Led Zeppelin back together.
What I'd like to do would be good to you. And if you hang up on me now, I'll be filled.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
And if I can get to love you, what's the telephone bill?
My name is Ian. Regarding Nick Drake, I'm English. I was at college in those years, 68, 69. In my group house, we had both Five Leaves Left and Brighter Later as soon as they came out, and listened to them all the time. Five Leaves Left, you may not know, refers to a little piece of paper that appeared in a packet of cigarette papers. After you got partway through the packet, it would say, okay, you've got five leaves left. So it was a nice joke that we all enjoyed.
You'd see so frail. In the cold of night, when the armies of emotion go out to fight.
And it's so thrilling to me that my children and a lot of people even younger than them are now enjoying his music. It's so brilliant. Yeah, we knew it then. Thanks for your great show.
Sail to the sky.
Hey, this is Colin Flanagan. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. Just caught the
tail end of your segment about Japanese music, I wanted to tell you guys about an artist called World's End Girlfriend. It's actually just one guy, one producer, plays a bunch of instruments, does these incredible soundscapes that start off as sort of neoclassical compositions and then slowly morph into these schizophrenic monstrosities, and then somehow he brings it all back. So if you haven't heard him, check him out. That's it. Thanks a lot, guys.
Hi, John Kutch from Harvard, Illinois. Just listening to the Japanese music show, and I think you guys missed out on the chance to showcase The Pillows. It was a real rock band and not some J-pop. They were the band from Fuyikui, which all the hip kids know is one of the best Japanese anime cartoons out there. But I think you should consider The Pillows as a great Japanese rock band.
Hey guys, my name is Joel. I'm from St. Pete, Florida. I just heard your show where you had the Shuggy Otis song, Strawberry Letter 23, as the Desert Island Jukebox. And I never knew that it was a cover when Brothers Johnson did it. I'd been in love with that song ever since I heard it in the movie Jackie Brown. Thanks for teaching me that, and keep doing what you're doing. Bye. Stay with the
more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.